Thanks very much, Jesse. Michael? Our first reading is an excerpt from Robert McAfee Brown's book, Spirituality and Liberation. That may sound familiar. Giving an example of the integration of spirituality and social justice.
Peggy Hutchison stands in the United States District Court in Tucson, Arizona, Judge Earl Carroll presiding, waiting to be sentenced. She's been found guilty of conspiracy in violation of Title 18, United States Code 371. In less abstract language, she's been convicted of helping political refugees escape from death squads in El Salvador and Guatemala so they can find sanctuary in the United States until it is politically safe for them to go back home. Has she anything to say by way of mitigating evidence before sentence is imposed? She has. She tells the court that her family and the United Methodist Church both helped to shape her values and taught her that beliefs didn't mean anything unless she put them into action. Her church enjoined her in its discipline to be part of a witnessing and serving community. As she worked with political refugees on both sides of the border, she soon realized, as she informed Judge Carroll, that they have fled torture, they have fled imprisonment, civil war, and death, and that to turn her back on them would make her complicit in actions that would imperil them all over again. She discovered by bitter experience that the immigration courts, the procedures of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and the policies of the Border Patrol were conspiring to make it impossible for political refugees to escape deportation. She reminded the judge that the United States had reacted with similar callous disregard to the plight of Jews seeking to emigrate to the United States after the rise of Hitler, and that never again must that happen. She came to the conclusion that our immigration laws were not being fairly administered and that the lives and deaths of people must be our paramount concern. As she said before at her trial, her political involvement was heightened not just by her study of the law, but by her study of scripture. Passages like, "Do not mistreat foreigners who are living in your land. Love them as you love yourself," jumped out at her. Jesus' admonitions, as she summarized them, to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, welcome the stranger, take care of the sick, and visit the imprisoned, seemed to have been written for the precise situation in which she found herself, and they could not be ignored. In the face of this conflict between human law and divine gospel, she reports that she spent time in meditation, reflection, and prayer. Rather than providing relief from her political dilemma, the meditation, reflection, and prayer confronted her with a series of options from within which she knew she had to choose. I could collaborate with the United States government, which helps sponsor the torture of thousands of people. I could learn to live with the atrocity, or I could stand with the oppressed and persecuted Salvadorans and Guatemalans and respond to these sojourners in my midst. The consequence of making the latter choice not only heightened her political activity until her arrest, but simultaneously deepened her faith, a not surprising consequence, since in her life, political activity and faith are not two, but one. Our second reading is from the works of Mohandas Gandhi.
It is not at all impossible that we might have to endure every hardship that we can imagine. And wisdom lies in pledging ourselves on the understanding that we shall have to suffer all that and worse. If someone asks me when and how the struggle will end, I may say that if the entire community humanly stands the tests, the end will be near. If many of us fall back under the storm and stress, the struggle will be prolonged. But I can boldly declare, and with certainty, that so long as there is even a handful of people true to their pledge, there can be only one end to the struggle, and that is victory. First, we seek ourselves. We want to establish who we are. We want to tell the universe, here I stand. If you expect this spot to be empty, you would be wrong. If you thought you could move through this spot and there would be nothing here, you would be wrong. I am here. I take this space like everything else the universe takes its space. I am not nothing. It is a simple thing. A mountain is a mountain. The self is the self. Then we become interested in all this whatever it is around us. What is the meaning of life? What gives me purpose, direction? We seek something outside ourselves, community, the transcendent, something bigger than ourselves, something that will secure a sense of value to the lives we live. A mountain is so much more than a mountain. It is the product of geologic forces that are off the human scale. The earth is a product of cosmic forces that are off the earthly scale. A mountain is habitat to the very small and an atom to the very large. It is not a simple thing. A mountain is not a mountain. The self is not a self. It is the product of personal and social experiences, some of which the self has complete say over, some of which the self has some say over, some of which the self has no say over. The self has effects on other selves, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse, sometimes with much thought, sometimes accidentally. Our experiences and reflections upon our experiences of ourselves as both causes and effects build ourselves, making ourselves ever-changing. It is not a simple thing. The self is not just a self. The Dalai Lama has an ultimate concern. It is not Tibetan liberty or autonomy. Ultimate concern is a concept explained by the theologian Paul Tillich. By ultimate concern, Tillich means that which orients a person, much like the needle of a compass orients its every movement by the magnetic North Pole. The needle's ultimate concern, the only thing it can use to orient its movements, is the magnetic North Pole. To anthropomorphize the needle even more, the needle may be thought of as worshiping the North Pole. All the world is understood in relation to this pole. I can think of no one who does not have an ultimate concern. All will and choice is guided by this pole, whatever that ultimate concern may be. A person's ultimate concern functions as their God. The Dalai Lama finds himself most fulfilled when he is in service to others. He has occasional desires that are focused on serving himself, but he seems pretty successful at keeping them from becoming a distraction. If those desires go wanting, they do not undermine the joy he feels in service. But he freely admits that his ultimate concern is his own happiness. He openly says that service to others is a selfish thing because it serves his own happiness. Service makes him happy. Happiness is his God. It is a simple thing. It is not made more complicated by global politics. His happiness is not contingent on the success of his efforts. As expressed in the antiphonal reading, he gives his heart to justice, but not into its keeping. He serves. He is happy. It is a simple thing. A mountain is a mountain. The self is a self. This concept, this idea of a mountain is a mountain is not a mountain is a mountain, is also the hero's journey, in short, as described by Joseph Campbell. In his book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, Campbell writes, "The hero ventures forth from the world of common day into the region of the supernatural. Fabulous forces are there encountered, and a decisive victory is won. The hero comes back from this mysterious adventure with the power to bestow boons on his fellow man." So, a hero is just walking along, minding her own business, herself as a self. Then she goes off her regular path to track down a soccer ball that's been kicked into the woods. It is a simple thing. But deeper and deeper she goes, until she finds herself in the realm of spirituality. It is not a simple thing. Herself will be tried and tested. There will be dangers, real and imaginary. She will at all times have all the help she needs from others, and yet be utterly alone. Herself will be changed forever. Herself is not the self that she knew. She will endure the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune until a great victory is won, and she is made whole. She will return to her world and be who she was always, even if she didn't know it, but now with something new to give to humankind. Herself is herself. It is a simple thing. Robert McAfee Brown worries that people think of their spiritual journeys as separate from the work of social justice. He calls this the great fallacy. Brown's resolution, as expressed in the reading, might be mistaken for one that is relatively normative. Thou shalt do good works in accord with the wisdom, tenderness, and compassion expressed in the Bible, even if you have to fight the forces that make the law of the land. But wisdom, tenderness, and compassion for the tired, the poor, the huddled masses yearning to breathe free, is supposed to be more than an obligation. It is supposed to be the inevitable consequence of faith in a loving God. Similarly, for the Dalai Lama, service is the logical outcome of the pursuit of happiness. Or, in Joseph Campbell's depiction, our spiritual journey, our hero's journey, is not over until we apply ourselves to the task of making the world a better place. The work of Martin Luther King, the work that Martin Luther King asked of those in the civil rights movement, also fits this pattern. A person would arrive with a simple wish to participate in the march. But the march was not a simple thing. Not only was there the threat of violence, but the marchers had to present an image of dignity and self-control to the world. Workshops on nonviolence were given. Marchers would have to go through a period of spiritual cleansing, as he called it, as King entitled it. They would have to accept that they may have to let themselves be hit without hitting back. They would have to prepare to endure the hardships of jail. Then the person could do the simple act of putting one foot in front of the other. We tend to think in a very linear way. A mountain is a mountain, a mountain is not a mountain, a mountain is a mountain. It's a line of three steps. We think that way, but we don't live that way. The mythological tales, which Campbell cites, work that way. The movies work that way. In one of the Rocky movies, I'm embarrassed to tell you that I've seen most of them, Adrian, his wife, doesn't want Rocky to go back into the ring. So Rocky's heart isn't in his training, and he's floundering. Until Adrian falls into a coma after childbirth, and when she wakes up, she says to Rocky, I want you to do one thing for me. Win. And from that point forward, he's trained perfectly. He has perfect focus, no distractions. Every decision is the right decision. But it seldom works that way for us. Yes, we do have those moments that free us to do amazing things and to bring boons to humankind. Peak experiences, they're sometimes called. And we might expect them to last forever. And we might be disappointed when they don't. Then we have to revisit our obstacles and endure more trials. We move around on this path instead of taking it one step at a time in a line. We move from one to the other. Some days, service to others is a simple thing. Some days, we are our initial selves, desperately needing to assert our right to take up space. Some days, the self is not a simple thing and needs delicate and thoughtful attention. And when that day is over, we do not emerge as a finished self, never to revisit those complications, obstacles, or ordeals ever again. Perhaps because we tend to think in a linear way, we often spend much time looking forward to the day when we do emerge. Then I'll be a force to be reckoned with. Or then my life will fall into place. Then I'll be ready to be happy. But of course, as soon as we see ourselves doing that, we recognize how silly it is to wait for that day. If we wait, we may waste our time, waste our lives waiting for that day that never comes. And that is why we can't wait. Why we can't wait is also the title of a book that Dr. Martin Luther King wrote, the book that contains the letter from the Birmingham jail. There is more to me than just stream of consciousness to this why we can't wait connection. Dr. King wrote, "For years now, I have heard the word wait. It rings in the ear of every Negro with piercing familiarity. This wait has almost always meant never." And what were they supposed to wait for? Wait until people are ready. Wait until they are comfortable giving equal protection under the law to African Americans. Wait until society completes its spiritual journey, and then justice will just fall into place. Just as we cannot wait for our perfect selves to emerge in order to be happy, we cannot wait for our perfect selves to emerge before we love justice. We must take what we learn and apply those lessons to the tasks that need to be done, be they personal or political. So what now? We are here, each of us on our own journey, each of us here for our own reasons, and that is as it should be. But each of us, each of our journeys has brought us here today, in this place, together. Why is that noteworthy? What does it have to do with social justice? Well, there is an attack on the community. You may be familiar with the book Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam. The central observation of the book is that people are less connected to each other now than they were in the past. More people bowl alone now, fewer in bowling leagues. The same is true for many other social activities that used to facilitate the building of bonds. The average adult may have three careers in their lives. Those careers often mean relocation. Relationships are lost. Communities lose the strength those relationships among its people convey to them. People have, on average, about one-third fewer close friends and as many as six fewer friends in general now than they did 25 years ago. We are more alone than we have ever been in living memory. The world is a harder place than it has ever been in living memory. More and more people are watching their dreams pass over the horizon and out of sight. The personal and social institutions that might help them are deteriorating. So our beloved community means more than ever. Michael Greenman's work on community in troubling times, the work of Dick Dawson and the pastoral care team, the covenant groups, the work of the Racial Diversity Task Force, among many others here at this church, are all powerful ways of responding to the stresses our community feels. So why is it significant that all of our individual journeys have brought us here today? Because it gives us the chance to be here not just with each other, but for each other. But being here for each other is not going to just fall into place either. It will take intentionality on our parts. We will have to look each other in the eye, make contact, and build relationships. In Campbell's depiction of the hero's journey, the hero always has help. Somebody gives her a mysterious object that she needs to overcome an obstacle. A number of turtles will appear to allow her to cross a stream by walking across their backs. Then they will disappear before the monster that is chasing her can use them. So though the hero is in one sense utterly alone, she must win the great victory by herself, she is also never alone. In beloved community, yes, we are here, each of us on our own hero's journey, and that is as it should be, but we are also here together. And we can be helpers in each other's hero's journeys. To that end, I ask you to close this sermon in song. You will preach the rest of this sermon and to yourself and to everybody around you. We will sing hymn number 95, "There is More Love Somewhere." But we are not going to sing "There is More Love Somewhere." We're going to substitute the words "right here" for the word "somewhere." Please rise as willing and able.